recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and when they're available, which is really whenever you're interested in listening to it on your iPod or whatever type of device or computer or desk or however you choose to do it. Today we have a really an excellent show as we explore the often criticized world yet unanimously adopted world of finding ESI through keyword searching. We all do it, nothing to be ashamed of, except maybe the adage that the definition of insanity is repeating the same mistakes over and over. So what's all the fuss about? Maybe keyword searching works well enough. Maybe there aren't better alternatives out there right now, and maybe if we have time after deciding whether keyword searching is a good idea, we'll cover whether or not the Tooth Fairy exists. I understand we have some fairly recent mothers on the call, and they it does exist. I've made a lot of money through the Tooth Fairy so over the years. So anyway, with that in mind, we probably won't get to that since I expect a lively debate over keyword searching to emerge here. The first panelist on the show, Brian Pania, is an associate at the Washington, D.C. law firm of Wiley Ryan, and is really important to the show because, you know, at a coffee meeting we had, he suggested this topic based on what he sees in the trenches of doing just normal cases. And so I thank Brian for coming up with the topic. He represents a variety of clients and matters related to the enforcement and procurement of intellectual property rights with particular focus on patent litigation and counseling. He's had a number of cases that have hinged on e-discovery type issues and how you manage discovery. Brian's also co-chair of the American Bar Association section of Intellectual Property Law Patent Litigation Committee and the Business Method Patent Issues Subcommittee. So great to have you on the show, Brian. Thanks for your insights. Second panelist here is Alexandra Chopin, who works at another D.C.-based firm, Patent Boggs. Alex focuses her practice in general commercial civil litigation. Importantly, she's the founding member of the Patent Boggs Electronic Discovery Team, and she provides strategic advice and detailed protocols to help clients meet their legal and technical challenges of preserving and producing electronically stored information when litigation is ongoing or expected. She's regularly working with ESI and counseling clients and lawyers about these issues. She's developed training materials, done lots of seminars, speaks on the e-discovery circuit, and appreciate having Alex on the show with us. The third panelist is from up in my old hometown area, New York City area, Brendan Schulman. And Brendan works at the law firm of Kramer Levin, Naftalis and Frankel. His practice involves all aspects of commercial litigation in federal and state court and arbitration tribunals. Brendan serves as Kramer Levin's e-discovery attorney also. He's in that capacity, he advises clients on preservation, collection, processing, review, and production of electronic information with an emphasis on early case assessment and other cost-effective and defensible strategy. He also counsels attorneys and clients on effective discovery strategies and advocacy with a view on emerging developments in this rapidly developing field. He writes quite a bit in this area. He's also a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group 1 on Electronic Document Retention and Production. And I always like to mention whenever someone went to Harvard Law School, because I always think that's something I wish I'd done, but I didn't have that chance. So anyway, great to have you on the show, Brendan.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And our last panelist was a last-minute addition. Thinking about this topic in a lunch meeting I'd had with Jim Batson recently, also up in New York, Jim's a partner at Little and Robinson and focuses on the plaintiff side. And, you know, the keyword issue really affects both sides. And I thought it would be nice to have someone from that perspective also on the show. Jim represents individuals in all aspects of litigation. Although employment disputes make up the majority of matters on which he works, his experience also encompasses a broad array of commercial disputes. He has been a leader in the field of e-discovery. He was counsel of record for the plaintiff on the widely followed Zubelik versus UBS Warburg decision. And Jim, glad to have you on the show as well.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. So first of all, starting off, you know, in the order of how I introduced you, I'm always interested to hear how you first got involved with electronic discovery. So, Brian, why don't we start with you? And
well, thank you, Carl, and I appreciate you putting together this panel and this program on this topic. You know, I got involved in e-discovery like a lot of people. After the 2006 amendments to the federal rules, we had a fairly large biotech patent case. That dealt with hundreds and hundreds of gigabytes of electronic data to be searched and collected. And, the one thing that's been a characteristic of a lot of the patent cases we have, that in addition to involving high-tech matters in the case, there has been a lot of e-discovery, and, that's been a large part of almost every patent case today, and it's something that in the past few years, it's an area that I think we learn new things every day in electronic discovery, and it's an ever-changing field and something that I enjoy being involved in.
Okay, and Alex?
Well, Carl, I think you might know that I'm uniquely qualified here because my parents sent me to the Pine Tree Community College Summer Computer Camp in Boca Raton, Florida when I was in the fifth grade. But it was really actually about a year or two into my practice in about 2003 in Atlanta. I was litigating a case for a plaintiff who had claimed that two big bad companies had made off with his business model and his technology. And I was a young associate sitting at my computer, and I received a package of CDs from Hunt and Williams, who represented the opposing parties. And when I stuck the CDs into my computer to retrieve, the defendant's documents, my computer wouldn't open them. And after many calls to IT, we figured out that was because the CDs were actually DVDs. And this was really the first experience I had with getting overwhelmed with electronic information. There were so many documents on these CDs that in getting quotes from vendors, they were talking about it will cost you $600,000 just to print these documents. Nobody was really thinking in terms of, can we put them in a document review database? Nobody really did that. They only thought about what would we do to put it into paper. And so as a result, we settled the case because my client couldn't even afford to get into the discovery. I mean, that was $600,000 just to print the documents, much less to review them. And so since then, I've been really focused on how not to get kicked out of our cases just based on the cost of discovery. You know, how do we manage and get through these masses of information and actually get to a place where we can effectively litigate?
Did you call your Boca Raton summer camp counselor when you got the DVD? Anyway, all right, Brendan, how about yourself?
Thank you, Carl. I'm someone who's been interested in computers since I was very young, and actually was the guy that everyone went to for computer help, so much so that it turned into a part-time job in college, helping students use computers. And that was back at really the dawn of the Internet as we know it today, with the release of Mosaic, the first Internet browser. Fast forward a few years, as a lawyer in connection with my commercial litigation matters, seeing the increasing importance of electronic data and computer systems, both in terms of the process of litigating, but also legal strategy, discovery being where many of us spend a lot of time before we get to depositions or pretrial motions or the trial itself. I took an interest and was involved in my firm, and a few years ago, recognizing my work on the technology committee here and also the value that I think many of us bring to our clients in terms of e-discovery expertise, my firm asked me to take on the more formal role of e-discovery attorney so that we could bring that experience to both the client teams here and all of our matters.
Okay, and Jim, how about yourself?
Well, it started, as it does for so many litigators, with a case. You know, I had a litigation against a Wall Street firm, and we were getting ready to take a slew of depositions, and the other side had finally represented that they'd produced all their documents, and that production contained about 120 emails. And I knew that that seemed way too few for two reasons. One, my client had saved about 400 emails, and two, those were supposedly responsive emails covering a two-year period and 10 custodians. So we went to the magistrate judge at the time, Magistrate Judge Gorenstein, and said, you know, this is a Wall Street firm. We know they have document retention policies. We just can't believe that they only have 121 emails. And at that conference, my adversary said, well, actually, there's a lot more, but they're on backup tapes, and it's going to cost $300,000 to restore them, and we think the plaintiff should have to pay. And after some preliminary depositions on that issue, we made a motion to compel, and surprisingly, we found out that that motion was not going to be decided by the magistrate to whom discovery was assigned, but rather to the district court judge, and that was Judge Shinlin, and that led to the first Zuba Lake opinion, first of seven. And you know, I was off to the races on e-discovery through Zuba Lake, you know, and after that, you know, experience, and this was pre the 06 amendments, although obviously the Zuba Lake opinions were influential in those amendments. I suddenly became an expert in a burgeoning field.
Yeah, it's interesting how we all got here. I like asking that question. Well, let's jump into the topic now, Brian. Let's start off. Let's talk about following the playbook perfectly. Everyone's talking about meeting, conferring, and agreeing with the other side on keywords. What can go wrong in this situation once you've gone back to the computer and tried to find the relevant ESI?
Well, I mean, let me begin by saying I think that from a litigation standpoint, keyword searching is a good idea in principle. And when you're in a disputed litigation, as most litigations are, there is something reassuring about knowing what words the other side is searching for, and also reassuring to yourself that you're searching for words that seem to match up with the relevant documents. But what so often happens when you do keyword searching is that keyword searching is not directed to the specific terms that are relevant, but rather ends up becoming a lowest common denominator exercise. And what you find out is that you get a lot more documents than you ever envisioned getting. You know, when you do your meet and confer, you come up with your keywords, or if you come up with them on your own, you know, you have a good idea of what words will be in the relevant documents. But what you don't always consider, and sometimes don't have the means to envision, is what the irrelevant documents also will consider. You don't realize that these keywords that may be found in your relevant documents also are in, for every relevant document, it'll be in 50 or 100 irrelevant documents. So when you run your keyword searches, you go back to your computer, look at the documents you've uncovered, and you find that you have way too many documents to review, the vast majority of which are not responsive to any of the document requests that you're responding to, let alone relevant to any issue in the case. And you know, the one example that I think that a lot of people have experienced is, you know, you spend a week reviewing documents, you search through gigabytes of data, and you only come back with a few dozen, a few hundred, a few thousand responsive documents, despite the keyword uncovering gigabytes of data. So it's keyword searching is a very coarse filter and imperfect way of identifying documents, and very over-inclusive.
And Alex, I know you've studied this a bit and talked a little bit about this in other areas. Why do keywords often cause problems in a case?
I mean, beyond the weeks or months and expensive motion practice it can require for the parties just to agree on the keywords?
Heck, you can answer with that too.
Well, there are actually plenty of reasons if you're talking about the specific keyword searching itself. I mean, for one, we want to use keywords in English. Let's say that's the language we're speaking. But data is written in computer. Keyword search engines really don't understand your question. They find documents or data that match the words in your question. As a result, when you search for concepts or documents on a particular subject matter using certain words, the software is looking to match the specific words you're searching for. And so we receive tons of data that doesn't relate to the subject matter of what we really care about. You know, specifically, search engines can't find documents that contain keywords you didn't enter, but that mean the same thing as words you did. So, for example, you can't locate documents that contain the word cheddar if you only enter the term cheese. Some search engines have trouble with what we call stemming. Like if you search for the word hot, should the search engine also search for hotter and hottest? The engine may also not know how to treat singular and plural words and different verb tenses. And keyword searches also have a tough time telling, or the engines that are applying the searches have a tough time telling the difference between words that are spelled the same way but mean something different, like the difference between hard drive and hard test, or between carpool and carsick. So if you search for the word hard or car in that example, you're likely to get a whole bunch of irrelevant documents in your search set. And then beyond that, everybody speaks English differently and uses certain words to mean different things. Although lawyers try to make provisions in a contract uniform, which lends to fairly simple searching, most of the documents we're searching for in our cases these days aren't the contract or other legal documents at issue. What we're really looking for are emails and memos and correspondence, documents that by their very nature use different tones, sentence structure, abbreviations, and language depending on the author, the audience, and the format. So to try and come up with a uniform keyword search that will find documents about, you know, the June 1st conversation between two employees, for example, is extremely difficult when you consider these other factors, that the June 1 conversation won't be discussed the same way by two HR managers as it would by two work buddies who are chatting on email or via instant messaging. And not to mention, documents are filled with spelling errors, especially emails sent from mobile devices. It's apparently hard to drive and type accurately at the same time. So as a result, we either get under-inclusive or over-inclusive searches, and we use these, you know, we might use giant lists of keywords designed to reach content across all these different communication methods to, you know, address these problems that I've just mentioned. And there's one case from 2009, the Fannie Mae case out of the D.C. Court of Appeals, that reported using 400 search terms, which tagged out 80% of the government agency's entire email archive. And in one government investigation I had, the government gave us about 12 single-spaced pages of keyword search terms, which pulled back, as you can imagine, terabytes worth of data. So these giant keyword searches obviously are giving us massive amounts of irrelevant information that's very costly to review. Alternatively, if you try to do a narrow search to reduce the amount of data there is to review, you're pulling back under-inclusive data sets, not reaching all of the relevant information in a case. I would just say that, you know, when we try to search for data using keywords, we might find large amounts of data, but there's no assurance the data is useful or comprehensive enough to locate the documents responsive to written discovery or needed to help build our cases. And I read this quote once that I liked very much. One commentator said, you know, keyword search engines return haystacks, but what we're really looking for are the needles. And I think the keyword search problems we're discussing here really evidence that issue.
So Brendan, why do we still use keywords? I mean, what works with them?
Well, there's a number of reasons we still use them. I think first and foremost is that keywords are intuitive. They're the way that we think about documents. Google has been around since, I think, 1998, and of course before then there were other internet search engines. Everyone has essentially been using those tools in their daily lives for about a decade. And we've become trained, I think, to use words to search for information that we're looking for. Also, as attorneys, we've been trained in the same way. Westlaw and Lexis have been around in one form or another, I believe, for about 30 years. And in law school, many of us learn to search for the relevant cases and do our research using search terms that we believe to be the most relevant. So that's really the first reason. I think the second is really something that lawyers want in terms of a concrete goal. Keywords are a limited list of things. You can understand what is on the list. You can add to it, modify it, subtract from it, and that lends itself to negotiation, really the same way that I think a contract, let's say, might be negotiated in order to include or exclude terms and provisions. So I think keywords inherently appeal to attorneys because we can either agree upon them, we can argue about them. If we can't resolve it, we can take the list to a judge and have a ruling one way or the other. Someone's going to make a decision, and that decision can then be explained to everyone involved in the case. And that's the reason, actually, I think the clients like them too, because they can understand or at least they think they understand what types of documents are going to be retrieved and looked at by the attorneys and potentially turned over to the other side. And of course, finally, I would say the other reason driving our continued use of keywords is that we've seen courts adopt that approach in recent years. And as attorneys, we all like to rely upon precedent, and the precedent that exists on this point, how to retrieve information from vast sources, is to use keywords. So for example, when Magistrate Judge Peck issued his decision in the William A. Gross case here in the Southern District of New York last year, that's the case that famously starts off with the phrase that it's a wake-up call to the bar about the need for careful thought and cooperation in designing search terms and keywords. He did two things. First and most obviously, he was emphasizing the importance of careful keyword selection and cooperation with your adversary. But more importantly, I think, is that he was inherently endorsing the whole concept that keyword searching is the right way to go about the process and to get through that huge volume of documents. And we've seen that echoed throughout other decisions across the country. So I think it's a combination of everyday familiarity and judicial endorsement. And in terms of what works, I think, you know, generally speaking, we do find that notwithstanding the errors that that Alex pointed out, where you can't catch typos and the like, we do tend to end up with a fairly relevant set of documents at the end of the day.
So Jim, you're on the plaintiff's perspective. It almost seems like you're going to Vegas. Yeah, let's go find some keywords and see what we're going to find. I mean, is it easy, first of all, to agree on keywords in practice? And is it easy to come up with good keywords from your perspective?
Well, you know, unfortunately, the answer is not a simple one. You know, it can be. It depends on the case, and it depends on, from my perspective, on my client's knowledge. I obviously rely heavily on my client as far as what he or she thinks would be the terms most likely used, the way in which they'd be expressed, the parties that would use them. Obviously, some people, as was noted earlier, some people speak differently than others and send emails in a different way than others. But it depends on the case and how much is at stake, how knowledgeable your judge is, because if your judge isn't that knowledgeable, then there's an incentive for the producing party to be more resistant. So there have been many cases where, you know, as was just pointed out by Brendan, where parties can negotiate, where I can negotiate on a list of terms that we can all agree on. But then it becomes, well, what happens next? What happens if the terms that we agree on yield, you know, what we both consider are way too many hits? Or what happens if the terms we agree on yield on a number of hits which I think is appropriate and my adversary doesn't think is appropriate? So there really are a number of levels of agreement that need to be reached with keywords. And where we have the most success, or where I find it works the best, is where my adversary and I agree, okay, let's come up with some keywords. We don't necessarily have to agree that these are the right keywords. You pick yours, I'll pick mine. We'll agree on a number of terms. And then let's look at what the universe of hits is and agree to come back to it again and revisit it and work on subsets and basically make keyword searching works best when it's an iterative approach where you're able to go back again and again to the pool to try and come up with what at least both sides can generally accept is an appropriate response set.
Alex, since you've become the hatchet bearer against keywords in this podcast, I should have asked, are there any studies out there which highlight the frailties of keyword searching?
I don't think I am the hatchet man. And in fact, you know, I was thinking about our talk today and realizing that I am my clients are often in a defense posture, especially I do a lot of government investigations and congressional investigations work. And it is to my great delight when the government insists on keyword searches often, because I know that we're not going to pull back very much of the responsive data. And if I've got a client who has, shall we say, an issue with their defense, then that puts us in a better position often. So it may be strategic advantage to using keyword searching. But, you know, the frailties we're talking about are, you know, issues related to searches themselves and the amount of data that comes back, and not necessarily about the difficulties that these searches create among the parties. I mean, that's a topic probably for another day, the extensive motion practice and whatnot and how parties will get into it over the designing these searches. But when we talk about the failure of searches to capture all of the relevant documents because of limitations in the search engine software, because documents contain misspellings, or that searches pull back massive amounts of irrelevant documents, which are incredibly costly. There have been some studies in this area, and the ones that are most often cited are the Text Retrieval Conference, TREC, we call it, Legal TREC, in 2007 and 2008, reported that the numbers are much worse than we could have imagined, that the keyword searching is likely to gather just about 22 to 24% of relevant data in a case. And then in 1985, there was a study called the Blair-Marin study that reported that the keyword searches of documents in a case only retrieved about 20% of the relevant documents there. And that was although searchers believed they had gotten about 75% of the relevant documents. Yeah, I would just note that with all due respect to the decisions that Brendan cited earlier, and courts are now actually questioning the usefulness and reliability of these searches. I mean, they often cited Victor Stanley case from the District of Maryland in 2008. Judge Grimm actually wrote that there is this growing body of literature that highlights the risks associated with conducting unreliable or inadequate keyword searching or relying exclusively on searches for privilege review. Another case out of the District of Columbia, a federal district court case, called into question whether attorneys were even competent to develop keyword searches without the help of linguistic or other types of experts. So I do agree that we go back to keyword searches again and again because that's the way we've been doing it, and certainly the Google world has perpetuated that. But it looks like there is a growing frustration that is making us look for some other options in the way we search for documents.
Yeah, and I got to add to this, since even though I'm moderating, I do work a bit in this particular area of e-discovery. I had the good fortune to be able to sit down with Judge Grimm and go through some concept searching approaches. We did sort of a WebEx with him, and he appreciated it, and it was amazing, but not so amazing if you think about it. He hadn't really looked at these tools before. Judges aren't in document review rooms. Many people would be happy not to be in document review rooms, okay? So getting to that minutia, it's really hard to get it to issue opinions in that space if you aren't actually seeing how it plays out. So, I think judicial education is a big part of it. I've been offering to show judges these tools whenever asked, and I've been offering too. But, in general, Brian, with keyword searches letting us down, where else can we go? Do you have any senses of strategies to improve us, get out and guessing on the right keywords?
Right. Well, I think there's two ways to approach this issue. One is from the lawyer side. The 2006 amendments to the federal rules were meant in many ways to treat electronic documents in the same way as you would treat paper documents. Yet, while we don't think twice about searching through 20 gigabytes of data, if you had that same amount of data put into paper form, I think almost every attorney would balk at sending a team of reviewers to go out and look through those documents to come up with relevant data. So, so from an attorney standpoint, one way to approach this is to when you get into the case, when you do your Rule 26 conference early in the case, is to work with the other side and to think critically. Do you really what type of electronic discovery do we need? What custodians need searched? What locations need searched? And it's naive to say that you're always going to reach an agreement with the other side for various reasons. But sometimes it is possible to limit the number of custodians that are searched or to identify priority custodians, priority locations, where instead of doing keyword search, you work with the witness or work with the document custodian to manually collect the relevant documents instead of doing a keyword search, which as Alex said, may only have 20-25% accuracy. Then, of course, from the other side, from a technical standpoint, there are other tools that can be used, such as concept searching, where instead of looking at one keyword, you look at the whole body of documents, and you have these keywords appear in certain spots. What words are near them, and that's one way to take keyword searching, which is a very coarse filter, and make it a slightly less coarse of a filter. So instead of looking at 10,000 documents, now you're looking at 2,000 documents and can get a better idea of where the relevant documents are and how are these words being used, what are other words that are being used to help you find the synonyms in your documents. And even in a patent case which has highly technical terminology, there aren't quite as many synonyms as the example of cheddar and cheese or the other examples we talked about, that it's still a valuable tool to use to identify where the relevant documents reside and how can you find them. And then once you've isolated them, then you can take a closer look at them as opposed to just sequentially going through, starting at document 1, working through to document 100,000, document 1 million. That's another way to get better results and in most instances save time.
Brendan and James, you care to speculate, and if anyone wants to add anything to this, speculate why we aren't moving away from this model quickly to embrace other tools, because it appears the threshold to improve isn't that high. I mean, I know we're
It's ignorance. I mean, in my opinion, it's really ignorance of the alternatives, and you know, I include myself in that. I purportedly have a lot more expertise than many practitioners out there, because you don't really become knowledgeable in this until you get thrown into the morass, which is admittedly happening more and more. But it's very hard to educate the bar as to the alternatives that exist to keyword searching for all the reasons that have been discussed previously. It's a methodology that people are familiar with from Google. It's a methodology that lawyers are familiar with from Westlaw and Lexis, et cetera. And to talk about the different variants that have these, you know, more complex sounding names and less predictability, and it's hard for them to understand. Then you have to translate that to your clients, who are ultimately A, bearing the cost, and B, bearing the risk that the new or different methodology that's being used isn't going to yield, you know, better results or will yield worse results. But lastly, it's the judiciary, which, Carl, you touched on a bit earlier. You know, it's they tend to be a bit behind the curve in these ESI issues. They're familiar with the law because of the decisions that have come down, but they're not in the trenches looking at documents and dealing with the problems associated with, you know, millions and millions of documents being produced. So it's hard to get people to shift from that. And plus, you know, we talk about cooperation, and there is a heck of a lot more cooperation and discovery in my experience now than there used to be. It's still difficult to really meaningfully have a dialogue with your adversary and say, well, don't you agree that this other methodology is going to get us both a lot more responsive documents? Because in many instances, the relationship is asymmetrical. You know, I'm suing an adversary who doesn't want me to get any more discovery than they absolutely have to give me. So they don't really have the incentive to find all the responsive documents. And it's easier for them. You know, we heard the example that was, you know, given earlier by Alex dealing with the government in a slightly different kind of relationship. But, you know, she was happy that the government wanted to use keyword searching because it was less likely to find, you know, negative information against her client. But I think the defense firms feel the same way, and there's a body of case law out there saying that, you know, keyword searches are appropriate. If I can't force them to agree to something else, it's rare that we're going to be able to agree, we come up with a collaborative approach.
I agree with James on the education gap. Remember, there's still a limited number of attorneys who are really proficient in the electronic discovery field and who even have heard of alternative approaches to what is otherwise very intuitive and familiar process. And with respect to the asymmetry that's often present in some of these cases, I agree. A defendant who bears a disproportionately large burden of discovery has a great challenge in trying to convince an adversary to try a new approach that either feels like it narrows the scope of the resulting production or turns that process into a black box. And to me, the irony is that before all this e-discovery world, before the e-discovery ESI world, it really was sort of a black box in the sense that lawyers would ask their clients to help them find documents. It would be a warehouse of paper, but a document collection would be done, a review would take place, and the attorneys would, in good faith, fulfill their discovery obligations and produce what they needed to produce. That wasn't a perfect process either, and neither is keyword searching, and these new technologies and approaches are not going to be perfect either. But I think the guiding principle back then and going forward is to do what's reasonable and in good faith to discharge our obligations in discovery. And there's also the issue of habit. You know, some litigants have been trained for years, again, in that paper world, to serve very broad discovery requests, try to obtain as many documents as possible for fear of missing something important, or in some cases, in the hopes of finding a smoking gun without knowing whether it exists. I think, though, with data volume increasing exponentially, it's really increasingly to the disadvantage of all the parties to argue that volume is good. Both parties are going to end up reviewing a lot of documents that really aren't important to the case, even if they're technically responsive to a document request. You know, my rule of thumb is that there are usually only about, say, 15 documents that really do matter in almost any litigation. And I think ultimately we need to move away from the notion that it's productive for us to try to look for every single shred of data. And I think those cases where there's asymmetry are bad examples, bad avenues for development. The more likely approach to moving things forward is when you receive a lot of information from opposing counsel and you have to get through the production and find what's important, that's where you're going to use some of these advanced tools, technologies, linguistic experts to find what you need in these increasingly large volumes of data. One great example is internal investigations, where the immediate goal is not to find every relevant document to a certain matter, but really to find the most important ones that may instruct the company as to what actions it needs to take immediately. And I think that's where we're likely to move forward, educate ourselves, and hopefully move to a better model than just the plain old keyword searching.
You know, it just appears to me what a daunting task that people like you, Brendan, and Alex have within a firm of, you know, hundreds, you know, in many cases, people like you, thousands of lawyers in a small department trying to train your litigators how to do things different, because they have to train the judges. You know, that's what lawyers do. These are the issues. So I think it comes down to you guys. That's why you're on the show, right? final question in this area is first Brian, and then I guess Jim on the plaintiff side. Can you see a scenario, and I got into this in one of my last podcasts, where we were trying to come up with scenarios on agreeing to produce maybe using concept searching, and it was an interesting dialogue on the cost-shifting case we had, but I thought of a different scenario where maybe you agree to produce using some keywords so everyone gets that warm feeling that we have some agreement, and, you know, maybe do some filtering with concept clusters, you know, so you have a baseline production. But, you know, also do some independent concept searching to try to find relevant information related to discovery. I mean, can we get to that world?
Yeah, I think we can. And I have two examples of how we can take this approach that you just described, Carl. One example would be what I talked about earlier in the podcast, where you identify priority custodians, priority locations. You can either use keywords or do a manual collection and production from those custodians of their electronic files, and then for the larger body of electronic documents, you do a keyword search and produce those documents. So you have for the baseline, you have the reassurance that you're pinpointing in on the most relevant, the most responsive documents. Then for the broader set of documents where there may or may not be a needle in the haystack, you still have those documents have been produced. And you know, sometimes you can even reach stipulations with your opposing counsel that there will be no inadvertent waiver of privilege by the production of these documents. You know, you have a chance to designate the documents for confidentiality after the fact. Then the second thing that I've seen and that has worked well is instead of doing a keyword search, reviewing the documents, producing the documents, you reach a stipulation with the other side that documents will be produced on the basis of no waiver of privilege, no waiver of confidentiality. You turn over your electronic file that you've isolated as potentially containing relevant documents. Produced to the other side, then the other side is responsible for searching the documents, identifying what is relevant, then typically before depositions, Bates numbering the document, producing it. So the burden of doing the search is shifted to your opposing party. So it's their problem. How do you find what's relevant in these documents? Do you do keyword searching? Do you do some other tools? Do you do concept searching? And I've found in cases where that has been used, it's generally an effective way to get through, or at least to avoid the burden of searching through mounds and mounds of electronic data that may or may not contain relevant and responsive documents that you may or may not be able to locate using agreed upon keywords.
Yeah, and this is Jim Batson. From my perspective, there certainly is an opportunity or a scenario where that could work. And from my experience, it really depends on who your judge is, whether you'll ultimately be able to convince them that that's appropriate. Because I think it would arise in the following scenario, where I would say, okay, I want the following 10 or 20 search terms to be used. My adversary says, if we use those search terms, we're going to get way too many hits. Or they do an initial run with those search terms, and lo and behold, it does yield way too many hits without even throwing numbers out there. Let's just assume that we agree it's too many documents for the producing party to have to review in the context of the case. Then I could say, okay, well, listen, let's use those. Let's agree on a vendor to host those, and let's agree on a vendor to run concept searches to further filter them. And then, the producing party would only have to review the documents that the concept search has yielded. And it makes a lot of sense, to me anyway, and it seems efficient. But the problem I think I would run into more often in practice is my adversary says, no, that search term's too broad. You need to just come up with better search terms. We shouldn't have to go through that. I don't think the court's going to order concept searching, and they may be right, and I'd have to convince the court that concept searching would work, and it doesn't have the degree of established methodology. It's not a protocol that is accepted as much as search terms are. I may not be able to convince the court that that's the right way to go, and if I can't convince the court, I'm unlikely to convince my adversary. So it really is a bit of a gamble or a guessing game as to whether you're going to prevail on that. And the big risk with all that is you're only going to be able to go to the court so many times with discovery problems before they just don't want to hear from you anymore. And we'll get really frustrated with both sides if we can't work it out. So it's a great methodology, and I hope it becomes more accepted. And we just need to get more studies and more publicity for how much more successful one can be using it.
Right. Well, we have a couple minutes left here, so to end this show, Alex, do you know what the tooth fairy's leaving these days for stray teeth?
Well, my daughter Serena hasn't lost any teeth yet, but I'll tell you, Carl, whatever it is, it ain't going to be enough to cover the cost of the keyword search document review I have to do later today.
Good ending. Okay. Well, great. Thank you to all of you, Jim, Brian, Brendan, and Alex, for joining us for another ESI Byte show. It's always a pleasure to have guests like you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows in the future. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of our show. You can remember our show and website phonetically. Sounds like Easy Bytes, if you sound it out, of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back, unless there's a tooth fairy involved. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.